From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor of The New Statesman, a progressive political and cultural magazine in the U.K., and author of the recently published book, The Influence of Soros, Politics, Power, and the Struggle for an Open Society. George Soros is a Hungarian-born American entrepreneur, political activist, and philanthropist who founded the Open Society Foundations, which, according to its website, quote, support individuals and organizations across the globe, fighting for freedom of expression, accountable government, and societies that promote justice and equality. Soros has given away more than $32 billion of his personal fortune to fund the Open Society Foundation's work around the world. However, this Hungarian-born Jewish billionaire, who, according to Emily Tamkin's account, survived the Nazi occupation of Hungary as a teenager by pretending to be a Christian, has been the subject of conspiracy theories, claiming that his influence is everywhere and all-encompassing. He is often derogatorily referred to as a, quote, globalist. That's a coded word that anti-Semites use to characterize Jews who are successful on the world stage and who often use their wealth to support liberal causes, causes that support democracies, the plight of immigrants, and open societies, as opposed to dictatorships and despots. Tamkin writes, quote, her book is not a biography of George Soros, who was born Georgi Schwartz in 1930 in Budapest, the younger of two sons of upper-middle-class secular Jews, unquote. Rather, it's the story of his influence in the world of finance, philanthropy, and politics, and how conspiracy theorists and some world leaders have exaggerated and distorted that influence. Our listeners may recognize Emily's voice because, in addition to a journalist and author, she's a frequent panelist on our sister program, Issues in the News, a roundup of the week's top stories. So we are delighted to welcome her on Press Conference USA to discuss her fascinating new book, The Influence of Soros, Politics, Power, and the Struggle for an Open Society. Among other things, we will ask Emily what motivated her to delve into the life of George Soros and to disentangle his actual influence from the very conspiracy theories that portray him as some sort of boogeyman on whom illiberal leaders are wont to blame their every problem. And Emily Tamkin joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance due to the coronavirus pandemic. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so good to virtually be with you today.
Emily, congratulations on your book, which I thoroughly enjoyed. In addition to shedding light on the real George Soros, you do a great job of reviewing history from Hungary's role during World War II to the Balkan Wars in the 1990s and, of course, to present-day problems. What did, in fact, motivate you to write this book about the influence of Soros? And how disappointing was it that you actually never got an in-person interview with him?
I will take the first question first. I have a research background in Russia and Central and Eastern Europe. So as a journalist, I wrote often about that part of the world and about what I see as some of the most pressing issues of our times, nationalism versus liberalism and democracy. And so I had written a couple of longer profiles about Soros and had already been to Slovakia and Romania to report on him. And so when somebody approached me and asked if I wanted to write a book on Soros, I sort of had the reaction of, well, if anybody's going to write this book, I'm going to write this book. And so I did. In terms of how, I will not lie to the good listeners of this program, it was extremely disappointing. I should say that I'm extremely grateful that I was able to interview him by email. And I will stress that Open Society made available to me everybody who I wanted to speak to. There was nobody who I reached out to who, when they went to get clearance, came back to me and said, no, we heard from the top that we can't talk to you. That didn't happen. But as a journalist, I know, and you know, it's always preferable to have an in-person or even phone interview because there's so much more back and forth. So in one interview, somebody asked me, well, what would you have asked him in a sit-down interview that you didn't by email? And I said, I don't know the answer to that because the whole point of having an interview by person or over the phone is that you hear something that maybe you weren't expecting and you ask a follow-up and you get different information that way. So while I was grateful to be able to include an interview with him, obviously I would have preferred for it to be in person, but it's, of course, his prerogative to not sit down with me.
Indeed. But I would just say to our listeners who would like to read the book that it was well done. And the answers you did get from him, even though in writing, were very, in my view, revealing. Let's talk about the hungry into which young Georgi Schwartz was born and the impact that anti-Semitism and other factors had on his formative years, beyond obviously forcing him to change his name from Georgi Schwartz to Soros.
Soros is born into interwar Hungary. So prior to World War I, the Jews of Hungary, that in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, were some of the most sort of, quote unquote, assimilated, if you will, in all of Europe. They really considered themselves Hungarians who happened to be Jews, and they were a part of the Magyarization, so the Hungarian National Project. They were a part of this kind of great, glittering Budapest society. And then World War I happens, and Hungary is on the losing side, and they lose a large chunk of territory in the Treaty of Trianon, which is the Austro-Hungarian version of the Treaty of Versailles. And, you know, it's not just about the territory. There are people who were Hungarians who are now suddenly outside of the country. Families are split up. And I'm not trying to downplay the trauma that this caused to Hungary. However, Hungarian Jews also thought of themselves as Hungarian. So they, too, thought of the Treaty of Trianon as their trauma. Until, when casting about for someone to blame, non-Jewish Hungarians settled on their Jewish neighbors. And there were a few reasons for this. The leadership during World War I had had some Jewish advisors, and then there had briefly been a communist government, which was run by Bela Kun, who was of Jewish descent, though his regime also hurt other Jewish people. So Jews are really scapegoated for the loss in World War I. And all of a sudden, you start having these anti-Jewish laws and quotas, which is why the Soros family changed their name from Schwartz to Soros when George Soros was 6 years old. It was to keep them safer by making them less obviously Jewish. And then, obviously, that is not enough because World War II happens. Hungary sides with the Nazis because that was the only way, they say, because that was the only way that they could have hoped to get their territory back. And when the Nazis took over Hungary, George Soros's father, Tivadar Soros, who had previously escaped from, in World War I, a Russian prison camp and made his way back to Hungary and truly knew what it meant to survive, he realizes that playing by Hitler's rules is not going to keep Jewish families safe. And so he procures both forged and borrowed documents with which his family and many other families are able to hide out and survive the war.
I wanted you to talk about that because I think it's very important to establish the fact that Jews were scapegoats in Hungary because it previews what we're seeing today with the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, and the renewing of anti-Semitic sentiment. But let's go back to young George Soros. And the fact that, you know, he lived through this, and I believe also through the Soviet occupation of Hungary, but he did manage to get into the London School of Economics in 1949. And there your book says that he discovered the writings of Karl Popper, especially a book called Open Society and Its Enemies. And in your view, to what extent did this mark the beginning of Soros's path toward fighting for democracy and against all forms of repression, whether from the left or the right?
It was obviously an extremely influential, I mean, not just that text, Karl Popper was actually his tutor while he was at the London School of Economics, but it was obviously extremely influential, given that the name of his philanthropic foundations come from that book. The basic thesis of Open Society and Its Enemies is that none of us can ever know what the exact truth is, but the best societies are those in which everybody is able to participate and take part in discussion and debate, and together we can all come toward a more perfect understanding. So it's against hard ideology, it's against repression, and it's in favor of a civic construction of society, right? One in which we can all participate to try to better ourselves and our neighbors, the individual and the collective. And though Soros doesn't start his philanthropic work really until the late 70s, that's when he does his first open society venture. Obviously, through the decades, that idea stuck with him because in the 70s, when he's making all this money in finance, he has this moment where he's like, what is this all for? I'm making all this money. I have enough for my family. If I'm going to die from the pressure of making money, I want it to be for some cause. He settles on the cause of open society and names it after this book that he read all these years ago at the London School of Economics.
That's really fascinating. And, you know, before we get into the Open Society and the impact of his foundations, let's talk about how he made his money, because that is a source of great controversy. He engaged in currency speculation, as you said in your book, back in the 1990s. Talk about that, you know, the tension between his financial abilities and his philanthropic ambitions, mm-hmm. which is really at the core of his work.
Well, Soros goes into finance in London and then moves to New York and eventually becomes one of the great hedge fund managers and arguably the most successful currency speculator, certainly of modern times. His currency speculation includes in 1992, the so-called breaking of the Bank of England, in which he and his colleagues very successfully shorted the British pound and contributed to forcing it out of the European exchange rate mechanism. In 1997, they did it again with the Thai baht, which many argue contributed to the Asian financial crisis. So to say that that happened is not conspiracy. That is what happened. I think, first of all, two things. One, to make very clear that this was legal. You can argue, and many have, and actually Soros has said that perhaps not all of this should be legal. But his main argument is, you know, I play by one set of rules in my day job, in my financial realm, and then another set of rules or principles in the political realm. My argument is that that's all well and good, but he is such a large figure in the financial realm that his actions have consequences in the political realm. So it's not just that he is making some decision on the stock market. If you are a powerful enough financial actor, that actions you take can help move a currency out of an exchange rate mechanism, which had consequences for Britain and the rest of the European Union. And actually, Helmut Schlesinger, who was the German central banker at the time and whose refusal to work with inflation rates so that the pound could stay within that band, he has said that, you know, perhaps you can trace Brexit back to this 1992 financial moment. So when you're such an influential financial actor that those actions have consequences in the political realm, to me, saying, oh, but I play by two sets of rules doesn't resolve the tension. I should also say that Soros himself is aware, at least to some extent, that there is a tension and that he has said, you know, maybe currency speculation shouldn't be allowed in the form that it currently is, and has said the super rich, such as himself, should be taxed more, and said during the Democratic primary that he thought that Elizabeth Warren was the strongest candidate, which is obviously not the person you would support if you wanted the rich not to be taxed. I don't think that he's completely unaware of the tension or of the paradox. I do think that the paradox is there.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor of The New Statesman and author of the recently published book, The Influence of Soros, Politics, Power, and the Struggle for an Open Society. Emily joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ethel Elut from Abuja, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, write to us at PCUSA@voanews.com, or better yet, like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our guest, Emily Tamkin, author of The Influence of Soros. And let's continue on, Emily. Let's go back to 1979. I think this is when he established the Open Society Fund in Hungary. What prompted him to open the fund there? What was the original objective, and how do you see it evolving over time, particularly in the 90s?
Well, in 1979, he actually started in South Africa because it was apartheid South Africa. So it was kind of the perfect example of a closed society that could be made open through scholarships to Black South African students. Unfortunately, what Soros saw was that the university was not using the scholarships as progressively as he might have hoped. He then ends up going back to his native Hungary, where he sets up what was there called the Soros Fund, because apparently open society was too political back in socialist Hungary. He was tremendously successful there. Their patented move was to give out photocopiers, which the government kind of couldn't say no to because they needed them. But you know, back then, the government had a lock on what information was readily available to distribute, and making more photocopiers available, as Soros put it, made people who were just ordinary people into dissidents, because suddenly they had access to information production and reproduction. And they gave out student scholarships, including to a young man by the name of Viktor Orban, who went on a Soros scholarship to Oxford, and to his Fidesz, which was then a student group and is now, of course, the political ruling party in Hungary. So he starts in Hungary and he's very successful there. And he sets up these foundations in different places with mixed success. So in Poland, it takes a little while to find the right director and then they find it. And actually the Stefan Batory Foundation, as it's known, is still in Poland today. He tries to set one up in China and is accused of being a CIA agent. And so that closes down. He works a lot in Russia, particularly in the 90s, trying to help with the transformation from Soviet to free market state. And it's particularly involved in giving money to scientists and to textbooks. So it's about information and the freedom of information and who has access to it and who gets to be empowered by it. In the 90s, he also set up foundations in the Balkans, where originally, when it was Yugoslavia, he actually didn't think that there needed to be an open society there. But as it became clear that nationalism was going to be the successor to Tito, he does set up open societies in Serbia and Bosnia and Croatia. And it really goes from being this little operation in Hungary to a global enterprise. And you really see, both because he takes on a higher profile financially through his currency speculation, and because the foundations grow and expand worldwide, Soros really, over the course of the 1990s, becomes a worldwide figure, though not the worldwide figure that we know today, because it's really in the 2000s. Although there were conspiracy theories about him in the 90s, and I write in the book about Hungarian political figures in the early 1990s who were incredibly anti-Semitic in their portrayal of Soros, or in the elections in Slovakia, when Mečiar loses power, as he's clinging to power, he's blaming Soros for trying to oust him. So you do hear it throughout the 90s, but it's really in the 2000s that Soros, not just the man, but Soros the myth, becomes a worldwide phenomenon.
Exactly. And I do want to get into that. But first, let me ask you about, I think, a question that you struggled with in the book, and that is, how does someone from the outside, how legitimate is it for someone of his stature and wealth can, you know, engage in these countries and promote these ideas? Isn't that somehow not so much unethical, but just not really wise? He is criticized for having this outsized influence because of his money. But in a sense, he doesn't really, from what I gather from the book, he doesn't really call the shots. But his money through the institution, the Open Society, to me, it seemed like it was a response to a lot of organic desire for greater political and economic freedom. Is that correct?
Yeah, I absolutely struggled with this. And I still don't have a clear answer to it, because the whole idea of an open society is that we're having an equitable discussion and debate. And if you have that much money, however good your intentions are, your thumb is going to weigh heavily on the scale. But on the other hand, he's providing money to people, as you say, who want it and need it and who are trying to affect change with it. And to me, the clearest example of this is in Bosnia, and the war there in the early 90s. Soros didn't typically give money to humanitarian situations. The idea was to give to societies before it got to that point by fostering liberalism and democracy. He felt that what was happening in Bosnia was that you had, first of all, it was just a horribly tragic situation and people were dying. But you also had this idea of an ethnic-based civilization as opposed to a civic-based society. That's a threatening idea, both to the concept of open society and to the ability of human beings to live safely and without fear. So he gets involved in the war in Bosnia, and they provide electricity and water in Sarajevo, and they provided newsprint so that people could still be informed. They put on like literary festivals so that people could still feel human, even amidst all this bloodshed and during this war. And his money went to the establishment of the ICTY, so the tribunal that ended up holding people accountable for war crimes in the Yugoslav wars. I don't know that any of that would have happened without George Soros and without open society, because the UN, they weren't doing it. To be fair to the UN, they did help the open society and help Soros in putting all of this into play in Sarajevo, but they themselves were not doing this. And so it's all well and good for me sitting in Washington, D.C. to say, well, I don't really think it's right for a billionaire to come in and give his money to these countries and these causes. But when I went to Sarajevo and spoke to people, both people who had worked for him and people who hadn't, when I said that, it was kind of like I was speaking some third language that neither of us knew, right? It was just like, what a ridiculous thing to say about money given during a humanitarian crisis. So I do still think that billionaire philanthropy and the concept of an open society, I still believe that these are fundamentally incompatible concepts. Having said that, I don't think that I am comfortable looking back and just condemning all of the money that Soros has spent, both because I think that there has been real good that's been achieved through it, I am because I think that the conversation that we're having now about this incompatibility is in part because of money that Soros has given, right? You give people student scholarships, you empower people, you enfranchise people. Part of what they do is turn around and say, well, wait a minute, why was I relying on you for that opportunity? Which is good. That's how it should be. And I think that that is also a part. Like, I think that our current moment in which we're questioning billionaire philanthropy and the power structures, I think that that is also a part of Soros's legacy.
Indeed. And I think he would even agree. It seems to me that he wanted his foundations to be more independent of his wealth and spin off into independent organizations.
He had thought that the only one that would continue, well, first of all, some of them already have in Europe in the early 2000s. They did spin off some of the organizations. And I think one could say that results there have been mixed given some of the political forces that have come into power in Central and Eastern Europe. But even there, when people say, oh, it's because Soros left, it's kind of like, well, but he's vilified there. So at what point does this become counterproductive? But he, at the beginning, thought that the only organization or thing that he founded that would outlast him would be Central European University in Budapest. Well, the main campus was in Budapest, and now that's the main one. That was the one that ended up lasting because the one in Prague was shut down. And the irony of this, of course, is that that university has largely now been kicked out of Budapest by the Hungarian government.
Indeed. Well, I do want to talk about that in a few minutes, but let's talk about when the demonization of Soros began in earnest. And if I'm not mistaken, you talk about 2015 when he was defending refugees who were fleeing, migrants from so many conflicts, particularly Syria, looking for shelter. That was, it seemed, when he really became this boogeyman for a lot of people.
Yeah, I see it as happening in three moments. There's the 2004 election here in the United States, where he becomes a major political donor and so attracts attention in that way at a scale that he hadn't before in the United States. Then you have Viktor Orban comes back to power in Hungary a few years later, and he and Arthur Finkelstein, the late Republican political operative, together go back into the archives of Hungarian conspiracy history and come up with this Soros, the boogeyman. And so you see before 2015 that Hungarian state media is starting to put out this idea of Soros' boogeyman, but it's really in 2015 with the migrant crisis that the floodgates open, especially in Hungary, but not just in Hungary, where you have, you know, Stop Soros laws that are called Stop Soros laws that make it illegal to help asylum seekers, and NGOs that receive foreign funding have to register. And I spoke to a gentleman by the name of Balint Maier, who was in the government in between the two Orban administrations, and who's a sociologist, and who himself has received funding from Soros when he was a young sociologist starting out. And he said that this is so effective because the perfect other, you know, it's all well and good to vilify liberal professors, but they're actually not the perfect other. The perfect other is a migrant, somebody who doesn't speak the same language as you, doesn't look like you, doesn't pray like you, doesn't eat like you. And so if you can combine that with a political opponent who's not actually running against you, and who, being Jewish, being in New York, having come from Hungary, you know, working in finance, combines all of these prejudices that people already have. And you can sell people on the lie that the reason that they're so afraid of this influx of migrants is because of this one man. That's effective. And indeed, it has proven politically effective around the world.
That's true. And even here in the United States, many Republicans have called Soros a globalist, which we said earlier is really code word for a Jew, and therefore anti-Semitic. It's really extraordinary. How does he react to all of this?
I think he's tried to deal with it with humor and says, oh, you know, if you judge him by his enemies, it's quite an effective statement in of itself. But I don't mean to suggest that this doesn't put Soros himself at risk. He has received a pipe bomb in the mail, and the Open Society office in Budapest moved to Berlin because they felt like they were not safe in Hungary. So it's not that it doesn't affect Soros and it doesn't affect Open Society, but the people who are more affected, I think, are first of all, the groups on the ground around the world who either have received Open Society funding or have been affiliated with Soros at some point, who are under tremendous political pressure from their governments when what they're doing is trying to help people in their communities. And I also think that it makes Jewish people less safe. We had the Tree of Life shooting, which was literally about somebody who believed that Jews were bringing in immigrants into the country. And that was why the Tree of Life shooting was carried out. And it hurts the people over whom Soros is apparently the puppeteer, right? So when you say that Soros is paying for Black Lives Matter protesters, which indeed some people have, that serves to delegitimize the protests. It strips the protesters of their agency. So yes, these conspiracy theories are about Soros, but they hurt many, many more.
Indeed. And we do hear your doggy next to you. He's next
so
to you.
So sorry.
That's okay. So we have two interviewees. Really, Emily, a terrific book. Certainly these types of epithets and the calling of Soros, you know, a globalist, this type of anti-Semitic language, which leads to horrific tragedies like the Tree of Life Synagogue. It's all a sad commentary, I think we can all agree, on the situation we're living in today, the political polarization and the demonizing of, once again, Jews, which is unfortunately as old as, I guess, Jewish civilization. But after researching and writing this book, what is your assessment of the actual, the empirical, and not this caricatured influence of Soros and his impact on combating authoritarianism?
I think he's been tremendously impactful in the financial realm, the political realm, but I really do think that his main legacy is in the philanthropic realm. And though I think that fundamentally, again, we need to get to a point where we're not reliant on billionaire philanthropists for this kind of fight, I do think that eventually, if this swings back in the other direction and this moment that we're in comes to pass, it will be in part because of people who have been empowered and enfranchised around the world, in part from the funding of Open Society. And if we get to a point where we're able to grapple with billionaires and billionaire philanthropy and make ours a more equitable society, a truly open society, I think that will be in large part because of Soros too.
And I think, like we said earlier, he would probably welcome that because, according to your book, he wants to promote systemic change. And he realizes that he has benefited from many policies or financial structures that have enabled him to make a lot of money. But at least from what I read in your book, he would not be averse whatsoever to those changes, which could have hurt him personally financially. How do you think George Soros would like the world and the communities he has helped to view his legacy?
I think that he would want to be viewed as somebody who understood that he does not have perfect understanding and who tried to give more people around the world more of a chance to contribute their understanding.
Emily, for the last question, I would like you to talk about Soros's view about the upcoming elections. I assume he's concerned, like many liberals, that our very republic, our democracy, is at stake in the upcoming election. If so, to what extent does he believe that the United States, particularly in recent years, has been slipping toward a semblance of authoritarianism, as some critics have argued?
I would say two things. The first is that he's obviously concerned. He's a major Democratic donor. He's given a lot of money towards this election. I think one could say, based on where the money has gone, that he does not want to see Donald Trump reelected. But I should also say that I interviewed Charles Gotti, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins, and who said that, and this is in the book, if Trump wins, then that's it. That's the end of Soros' legacy. And one of the questions that I asked Soros was, do you think that that's true? And he said, no, that this election, as important as it is, does not decide forever and ever and ever whether or not we're an open society. And so I think his view is that while this is an important election, there are more ways in which the struggle toward an open society and toward a civic-based conception of society, right, as opposed to a closed ethnic understanding of society, that regardless of how this election goes, as important as it is, that struggle will continue in lots of different ways.
Emily, I understand that there is actually an open society foundation here in the United States. And it would be interesting to know what types of activities and projects that open society funds, and especially if George Soros himself thinks that the United States, like some other critics have said, has been really slipping toward more nationalism and our system of openness, free media that has been under attack in recent years, that we need some work in those areas, whether Mr. Trump wins or Mr. Biden wins.
So originally, Open Society wasn't involved in the United States because the thinking was, well, this is not the society that needs opening. But in the 1990s, they did start doing work here. The first U.S. field office opens in Baltimore and worked on treating drug addiction as a medical as opposed to a criminal issue, and also looking at different ways to fund restorative justice programs as opposed to just throwing people in prison. And actually, just this summer, Open Society announced that millions and millions of dollars will be put toward that cause, criminal justice reform, into creating a more equal and equitable country for all Americans, regardless of race, and particularly for Black Americans who are disenfranchised in so many ways by our systems.
The book is The Influence of Soros, Politics, Power, and the Struggle for an Open Society. The author, journalist Emily Tamkin, she's U.S. editor of The New Statesman, and a frequent panelist on our sister weekend public affairs program, Issues in the News. Emily, congratulations once again on this terrific book, and thanks for taking so much time to share your insights about it.
Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance, Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.